Welcome to the Right Take Podcast, news, ideas, and conversations at the intersection of politics and culture, a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center. I will be your host, Mark Tapson. Welcome back to the Right Take Podcast. I am your host, Mark Tapson. Thanks very much for joining me here at the intersection of politics and culture. War is father of all and king of all. He renders some gods, others men. He makes some slaves, others free. That is a quote attributed to the ancient Greek philosopher Heraclitus, and it means that war has a sort of a grand impact on shaping or even creating societies, on steering the course of human events. From the very beginning of history, wars have been catalysts for epic shifts in power, the redrawing of maps, the raising up of some nations, and the tearing down of others. My guest today at the Right Take has actually written a book called The Father of Us All, War and History, Ancient and Modern, in addition to many, many more historical and political analyses, and a brand new book about how wars don't just shape and create societies, but can annihilate them as well, especially if those societies are arrogant enough to believe that it can't happen to them. He's a very well-known conservative pundit, historian, speaker, and culture critic, but he's not your typical pundit, just as he is not your typical ivory tower academic. His political analyses are infused with a measured wisdom and a clear-eyed grasp of human nature and the sweep of history that stem not only from his intellectual roots, but his literal roots to the land at his family farm in Fresno. I think that makes everything he writes and says indispensable, and if you're not familiar with his work, just stay tuned for my conversation with him, and you will see what I mean. I've known him for a long time, and I've been eager for this chance to bring him on and share his brilliant insights and to talk about his brand new book, which, as a history buff, I enjoyed immensely, and I'm sure many of you are history buffs too, but also like to draw lessons from history for the present, and that's what this book is about as well. So stay tuned. You don't want to miss this conversation. I know I say that about all my guests, but trust me, you do not want to miss this conversation. And let me say, as always, please take a moment to subscribe to The Right Take if you haven't already, so you can keep up with the conversations we're having here with important thinkers, writers, pundits, scholars, and storytellers. And if you like what you hear, a positive review would be greatly appreciated. Thank you, and don't touch that dial. My guest today at The Right Take is someone who, if you keep up with politics, needs no introduction. He's a great friend of the Freedom Center. He's at the top of my list of sources for political and historical insight into current events, and yours too, I'm sure. He's a senior fellow in classics and military history at the Hoover Institute and a professor of classics emeritus at Cal State Fresno, as well as a distinguished fellow in history at Hillsdale. He writes a weekly column for American Greatness. He's written or edited more than 24 books, including Carnage and Culture, The Father of Us All, The Second World Wars, The Case for Trump, The Dying Citizen, all great books, and his newest one, The End of Everything. And we're going to talk about that today and more. Pundits are very plentiful these days, but wise men are in short supply, and my guest today is one of those rarities. Victor Davis Hanson, welcome to the Right Take Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Victor, before we get to your new book, which I'm currently reading, let me ask you about the anti-Israel, pro-Hamas protests that, as we record this, are wreaking havoc on campus and off across the country. The protesters use a lot of hateful sloganeering and intimidation and even violence, and they come out in large numbers, so they seem to present a pretty fearsome force. But you wrote recently that on the rare occasions when officials actually take action to break up these protests or to punish those involved, the protesters fold like a cheap suit. I guess an example of that would be the protests at NYU, which dissolved within about an hour after the NYPD began to blow through them, making arrests. Why don't we see more pushback by authorities in the face of this chaos? Is it that they're too intimidated, or have they themselves been captured by wokeness? What's the reasoning there?
I think it depends on where the protests are taking place. For those that are in the city itself, remember that all of our big cities are run by left-wing mayors, and they've been given directions by the White House not to get the optics wrong. And by that, I mean, do not be shown arresting en masse or breaking up demonstrations of people who this administration feels might be central to the election, not just in Michigan, but and then the integral to that calculus is I think they feel that the Jewish American vote for all the protestations will be Democratic no matter what, and so they're almost in your face about how cynical they are. As far as the universities go, their attitude is, yes, if I survive congressional hearings or public attention, I'm okay, because the one thing that will not allow me to survive is if I cross the faculty and the students, and those are the people I have to deal with every day, and they're hard, hard left, they're anti-Semitic, they're pro-Hamas. And so that's why it's very hard for them when they come before Congress or they're interviewed to say anything untoward, because they know when they get back to campus that they will be fired. And the type of people who gravitate or devolve to those positions are people who have their entire life made ethical and moral compromises to get where they are. I say that not in meanness, but as someone who's been in academia 50 years and watched that administrative trajectory, it attracts a certain type of facilitator.
What are a few ways that we could end all this street theater violence and this anti-Semitic bullying and the shutdowns of bridges and freeways and the disruptions of lectures and all that stuff?
I think we could stop it very easily. The MIT president gave us a clue when she was asked why she was advising certain places on campus at MIT not for Jewish students to go because of threats to their safety. And somebody asked her, well, why don't you just expel the Middle Eastern students? She said, I'm afraid they might be deported. They would lose their visa. So if they're non-U.S. citizens and they break the rules of the university and the university then expels them, then they have no reason to be here. And their student visas would be expired and they could be deported. And I don't think it wouldn't take very long. One thing we know about all of these people, both those from the Middle East and on campuses, that they're careerists, they're elite. These are the elite of the Middle East. They're here on either golf money or rich parents, and they feel that they're exempt, and they say and do anything. But once they're, you know, you saw that with Ilhan Omar's daughter. She went into a meltdown. She said, oh, my clothes have been in a pile. They weren't folded. Oh, I don't have my lunch ticket. What am I going to do? And they all do that. And Vanderbilt, you know, oh, a student is changing her tampon, or why didn't we get Panera? So their entire life, they've never been exposed to the muscular classes and their hothouse plants. So you could expel them, and the Middle Eastern students do not want to go back to Gaza or the West Bank or Syria or Iraq, or they just don't. They, for all of their bravery on the barricades, pseudo bravery, when they get back home, they have to shut their mouth. And if they did that for any cause, they would be jailed or worse. So we could do that. I think we've got to take a hard look at what the universities are doing. They're charging Middle Eastern students and Chinese students a premium, and they count on that to subsidize their operating losses. I think we have to tell the universities that there's no reason that any of us have to subsidize this, so we should really take a hard look at the endowment income should be taxed. You know, why does Harvard have a $60 billion endowment and the income off that is tax-free? I think we've got to get out of the student loan business. It's $2 trillion, a mess. So if you did that and made the universities operate financially sound, you wouldn't have all this DEI commissariat. And the students would think, wow, I have to pay for this, and I can't just take a loan out and then default on it. A lot of this is too much money and leisure. I mean, the other thing is, and this is more controversial very quickly, is the DEI admissions since George Floyd are really repertory. And at Stanford, the quota is now 20% white the last 3 years. So that means that there's no SAT. And the faculty are confronted with students that, according to their own standards of just 3 years ago, would not have been admitted. And those standards were predicated on the level of coursework. So if you're letting in students that you think don't fit your standards of coursework, either you have to give them higher grades and inflate the system, or you have to water down the course load or bring new courses. And they're doing all three. They do not want to die on the altar of standards. So you've got a lot of students with a lot of time on their hands that are taking gut courses. And I think we're watching the meltdown of the elite, the idea of the elite university, sort of like the German universities of the late 30s, that, you know, they were the great universities of the world in the early 20th century. And by 1933 or four, they were just a joke.
I don't want to neglect your new book, so let me ask you about that. The End of Everything, it's called How Wars Descend into Annihilation. You've written a lot about war, but what is the specific angle of this book?
Well, you know, I had a contract with Basic Books for two contemporary, The Dying Citizen, The Case for Trump, and then Second World Wars and this book. And I only mentioned that because I didn't think it would be contemporarily, in the contemporary sense, relevant. But it seems to the last month or two, because the thesis is that usually when the defeated of a war conduct some type of negotiations, even Hitler or Germany or Japan or Italy, they survive the language, the people, the physical space, sometimes with great damage. But the idea of wiping out an entire people, the language, the culture, the civilization, the physical, is very rare, but it does happen. And so I just selected four of them that were iconic. And one was Alexander's destruction of classical Thebes in 335 BC. Another was the notorious case of wiping out Carthage in the Third Punic War. Another was the end of Christian Hellenic civilization in Asia with the fall of Constantinople, 1453, and then Hernan Cortez, erasure of the Aztec Empire. And I wanted to see how that could happen because it was aberrant. And there was a pattern to all of these. And then a few others I discussed peripherally. And all of these cities or an idea of grandeur, that they were still what they once were without really a rational assessment of their resources. They felt their fortifications, when the empire had collapsed to a city, were impregnable. Nobody had ever breached the walls of Carthage. Seven-gated Thebes, the Theodosian walls at Constantinople. They all believed there would be help on the way, that no one would ever allow Constantinople to fall, or the city of Antigone and Oedipus and Cadmus to be destroyed, or Hannibal's Carthage to be completely wiped off the map. And then, of course, they had no idea of who they were dealing with. These were not Genghis Khan or Attila the Hun or Tamerlane. These were systematic intellectuals. Alexander the Great was tutored, as you know, by Aristotle, companion of the philosopher Callisthenes. Scipio Milianus, who destroyed Carthage, he brought Polybius along to watch it, the great historian. He had something called the Scipionic Circle of playwrights and writers. Mehmet II bragged about the size of his library, even as he destroyed Constantinople. And of course, Cortez wasn't quite a barrister, but he was a legal auditor or clerk, and he was a very good writer. And he wrote beautiful letters to Charles V, explaining why he wiped out the Aztecs. So I tried to get a kind of a typology, and then in a pretty long epilogue, I looked at vulnerable peoples in the world today, defined by the neighborhood in which they live, the history of being threatened, their small population or area, and then what people have said. And I was kind of shocked. I looked at the Kurds, the Armenians, the Greeks, and the Israelis, and it was really amazing how many people have threatened to wipe these people, along with, you know, North Korea, et cetera, South Korea, but they've threatened to wipe them out with nuclear weapons, bioweapons, rocketry. And I kind of contemplate, would it be possible in the modern world with this advanced technology to do what happened in the past? And we're not just talking about defeated. We're talking in the case of Carthage or Constantinople, the erasure of the language, the civilization, the culture. So, you know, within 50 years, there was no such thing as Punic anymore, or the Theban dialect of Boeotian, or there was no Christians in Asia Minor that weren't under some sort of subservience. And I came to the conclusion that it's the same thing as in antiquity or more recent history. We just discount it. Putin would never do that. Rafsanjani didn't mean that when he said Israel was a one-bomb state. Erdogan was kidding when he said one day the Athenians would wake up and they would be under a barrage of Turkish rockets that would wipe out Athens. He didn't mean it when he said that Armenians have a rendezvous with the 19th century solution that his grandfathers used in Armenia. And when you see river to the sea, these people really don't mean the complete destruction of the Jewish people in Israel. And so the epilogue ends with, we should be careful because the unthinkable can happen. And usually the last idea or feeling of the attack or the doom is it can't happen here, and it did.
Can we take just one of these chapters, one of these societies, and drill down a little bit into the specifics of the process of how and why their end came about?
Yes. We can take, for example, the Carthaginians. They had fought two wars over a century and lost them, but they always had been given terms, exile Hannibal, pay indemnities to Rome. But unfortunately, by 149 BC, they were back on the ascendance. The city had 500,000 people, even though it was not armed. Rome had given it a lot of conditions, but when Rome sent an auditing team there, they were just shocked that the city was beautiful, it was rebounding, and all of its enemies, it was starting to address its North African enemies that Rome had unleashed as sort of peacekeepers. And so the famous elder Cato, Carthago Delenda Est, he finished every speech with that threat, Carthage must be defeated. So finally, the Senate just sent a fleet of about 70,000 soldiers across the Mediterranean in its narrowest strait. They landed nearby in Utica. The Carthaginians came out and they said, "What is all this about?" And they said, "Well, we're going to give you some ultimata. You've got to hand over all your weapons, and then we'll discuss things." And they did. They gave their catapults, their armor, their swords, their javelins, even their elephants. And then they said, okay, now the discussion begins, and we're going to have to destroy the city and move it 20 miles inland. And they said, we can't do that. And so they said, and then we're going to besiege you. So they brought two consular staffs, and they besieged this huge city. It's about 18, 20 miles. And they had the biggest walls in antiquity until Constantinople, and they were impregnable. So for 2 years, they couldn't do anything. And then finally, the Senate got serious, and they appointed an authentic military genius, a young man named Scipio Aemilianus, the adopted grandfather of the famous victor of Hannibal, Scipio Africanus, in the Second Punic War. And within a year, he surrounded the cities with a wall. He blocked up the harbor. And he detached all the routes of food and assistance that came into the city, and he systematically dismantled it block by block and destroyed the entire city of 500,000 people, killed all but 50,000, enslaved them. And then the Senate directed him to destroy the city down to the rubble. So they destroyed the entire city, and then they declared it inviolate. Nobody could get near it. They didn't sow it with salt, as the myth goes, but it was not to be inhabited. And then about 110 years later, Julius Caesar founded Carthago Nova, the new Carthage, about 20 miles away, and it was a Roman city. And it became, because the site was so opportune, it became one of the biggest cities of the empire. But we know from inscriptions and contemporary evidence, archaeological remains, that this culture in North Africa from Phoenicia, the so-called Punic culture, had its own language, literature, very sophisticated form of government. It was completely wiped out and it disappeared. And there was no idea after that. You couldn't say if anybody lived in North Africa, they were either an indigenous Berber or they were a Roman colonist, but there were no more Punic people. They were wiped out.
Wow. Very interesting. You write that the annihilations of these four cities present similar lessons about what we might call the Melian dilemma. What is the Melian dilemma?
It refers to the little island of Melos, and there's a very gripping account in the historian Thucydides. In 416, the Athenians, during peace, went into their island, sailed up to it, and said, look, you're neutral, but there are no neutral parties anymore. We know you favor the Spartans. And the Melians have a dialogue with them. They said, well, no, we don't want to be friends with anybody. They said, there's no such thing. You're either with us or with them. And they make the argument to reason. They said, but if you wipe us out, everybody in the empire will think you're cruel and want to revolt. And they said, well, we wish that were true, but unfortunately, human nature being what it is, if we wipe you out, they'll be more afraid of you and that nobody will do what you did. And they said, well, people are going to come. They're going to help us, the Spartans. They said, no, that's hope is dangerous comforter. They're never going to come. They never help. They don't help any. So it's a very cynical but accurate appraisal of human nature. And the idealism of the Melians gets them killed. And I use that as sort of I discuss that dialogue in detail as sort of a metaphor of what all of these cities made their fatalistic, naive assumptions that the people who were outside their walls wouldn't dare do that, or in the case of Thebes, the Athenians will come, or the Carthaginians said, well, maybe the Macedonians will come. And of course, people on the walls looked out over at the Dardanelles and said, oh, the Venetians are going to come. The Genovese will come. Christendom wouldn't let us, the greatest city, fall. And even the Aztecs said, at some point, all these allies that are helping Cortez will flip and then we'll be okay. And it never happens. It's kind of very scary because you see what that when Israel's sort of, not that it's in an existential threat, although I think it is in some ways, but you see all these people who are distancing themselves from Israel suddenly. And the Israelis seem very, and the Jewish Americans seem very bewildered, you know. It's like, what's going on here? This, how did we go from being very popular and supportive to something like 1930s Germany so quickly? And I think the answer that I found is that people have no ideology, that they gravitate to, very few people do, 20% maybe do, but most people gravitate to what they think is the majority or the safe point of view. And you have to stop that very quickly. And unfortunately, these cities were very naive. They trusted in idealism. They trusted that people would admire their courage, and that was just the opposite reaction.
Regarding Constantinople, you wrote that it fell in part because there was nearly as much strife inside the walls as outside. Is there a lesson there for America today?
I think so. I mean, if you look at the resources of Western and Eastern Europe that were opposing the Ottomans, even at their height, and this was their height in 1453, they were pretty good. They were pretty successful in keeping them out, at least of Western Europe. And, you know, Lepanto at 1571 is on the horizon where they just destroyed the Ottoman fleet. But at this point, there was three divisions, unfortunately, among Christendom. There was, of course, Eastern Orthodoxy and Western Christianity. But although we weren't quite at the Reformation, there was already schisms within Catholicism or the Roman Christian Church. And so there were people in Italy, for example, and people in France that thought that maybe it would be comeuppance for these Eastern Greek-speaking Christians with this wonderfully impressive city, which, by the way, the Franks had sacked in 1204, that maybe it deserved what it got. And so I think there were only about 4,000 Christians that came, and the city itself only had about 10,000 people on the walls. At one point, the population had been 1 million, and this time there's probably only 60, 70,000, 50,000 people living in Constantinople. They had all fled in fear of what would happen to them.
I don't want to give away any spoilers, but you conclude in the book that the modern world, America included, is not immune from repeating these civilizational tragedies like the ones you describe in the book. What are a couple of, or maybe even a few of, the similarities that you see between the factors that led to these annihilated societies you write about and America today?
Well, one of the things is that their militaries were at one point superb, and they just assumed that they were unbreakable, and that was not true anymore. The Carthaginians thought they still had the spirit of Hannibal, or the Thebans said, you know, Epaminondas liberated all of the Helots. We're the best army in Greece. Kind of, and when you look at the United States, after the Chinese balloon went across, when Biden said he would react to Ukraine on condition of whether it was major or minor, the intrusion, and then of course Afghanistan, we're 45,000 recruits short, never had that many in the peacetime army, and that's a direct. If you look at the people who are not joining the military, it's mostly white males, and I think that's a result not just of Afghanistan, but the DEI and the false accusation by Milley and Austin. There was white supremacists in the rank, which, by the way, the Pentagon investigated and released in December that there was no such clique. So the military is one thing. Financially, they were all. Well, in the case of Carthage, they would have been wealthy, but there were certain restrictions put upon it by Rome. But in the case of Constantinople, they were broke, and they had no money, and they had been profligate, and like we are, for a long time. There was no unity. You mentioned that. There was a lot of, in the case of Carthage, Hasdrubal, not the famous Hasdrubal, but another one, lesser person, he was executing some of his own people while they were being besieged. And in the case of Constantinople, the bishops were trying to unify with the Roman Church at the last second. They were trying to do anything to get help and to get everybody on the walls, even though there was a lot of divisions. Alexander played on that. He said that there were anybody who would support him could leave the city, and there were actual Macedonians within the city that had to be put in a garrison. So they were divided. And I'm not sure that if we were in a, I don't know, we all like to think that, well, in 1940, 39, 40, 41, the country was divided. We had neo-Nazis, actual Nazis. And then Pearl Harbor happened and everybody came together. But that was a very different generation that came out of the Depression, and a different type of education and family structure and demography. And I'm not sure that we assimilate or integrate immigrants. We have 50 million people now in the United States that weren't born here, highest in numbers and percentages ever. And I'm not sure if we were into an existential threat, we would come together, like we did after 9/11, and that was short-lived. So I think the United States has got fiscal, financial problems. It's got problems with its military, severe problems. We're 7 years behind in Javelin production, 5 years with 155-millimeter shells, and we're giving them all away, and we don't make them anymore at the degree we need. So I'm very worried about the country, to tell you the truth. And the university system, it's not just that it's corrupt, but there. And I'm speaking to somebody that, you know, works at Stanford, and you look at the curricula, and you talk to students and faculty, and they don't believe that it's preeminent as far as the level of coursework and the degree of excellence needed to graduate. It's pretty much everybody gets an A, and DEI runs things. And so this has come very quickly in the United States, and I think that's a good lesson, that decline can come very, very quickly. It's a choice. It's not inevitable. The United States has plenty of natural resources. It's got more fossil fuels than it knows what to do with. It's the greatest producer of food in the world. It used to have the greatest universities, but it's chosen a different path, and that's usually a result historically of not of dearth and poverty, but of affluence and leisure, unfortunately.
I think the left believes that our species evolves and advances not only technologically, but morally. And that we become more enlightened as the centuries go on. And they believe that because they don't really believe in the limitations of human nature. Is that where our hubris lies, in this sort of self-satisfied assumption that the lessons of the past don't apply to us?
Yes, I think you hit the nail. I've talked about one of my favorite writers of the ancient world is Hesiod. He wrote a long poem called The Working Days. about 800 lines, and he said that essentially with moral, with material progress comes moral regress, and that's a big theme in classical literature in general. But human nature is constant, but the more that people are educated and leisured and wealthy, they try to overthink or they contextualize things, and they lose that moral clarity. And then they create kind of a H.G. Wells Eloy class, and they don't believe there's Morlocks around. That was a big theme in The Time Machine by H.G. Wells. And I think that's pretty much where we are. They don't think that something like October 7th can happen again. So when you hear those kids, and they're not all from the Middle East, saying, you know, there's going to be a lot of October 7th, they don't really know what that means. They don't know that they really, you know, they say, I'm for Hamas. But they don't know what it would be like for people to come into their home and slit their throat and put their kid in a microwave and rape their mother. And that's what, this is what they did. And they would, when you say they're going to do it again and again and again, that's what you're talking about. So human nature never changes. But what gets scary about it is at certain times, people believe, the majority believe that it does change. And therefore, they discount what it's capable of. And that gives you something like Hitler or the Japanese militarist or Stalin or what we're seeing in the campus today. It's really, I think we need to use the right vocabulary. This is really a fascist movement by these Middle East students and their abettors here in the United States. They really do believe they can't make the moral distinction between a constitutional system in Israel and a fascistic, autocratic, dictatorial, bloodthirsty, terrorist clique. They don't see the difference, and that's because they've lost the ability to reason.
Speaking of hubris, do you see a lot of potentially disastrous hubris in our involvement in Ukraine? Congress just recently voted to send Ukraine another $60+ billion, seemingly convinced that Ukraine can defeat Russia. Do you see any parallels between what you've written in your new book and this ongoing war in Ukraine?
Well, I do, and I get very upset at a lot of people I like a lot. I agree we should give the wherewithal to defend their territory, but people are completely ignorant of the history there. When they went in and took the Donbass, Putin, and Crimea in 2014, that was because Obama appeased them, and he immediately did not say that he was going to use force to get it back. Trump said he wasn't, and Biden didn't either. And then suddenly that goal was bootstrapped on the defense of Ukraine. And so that led to this crazy idea that a country with one-fourth of population, one-tenth of GDP, one-thirtieth of the territory was going to have a Patton or Guderian-like armor thrust through a 600-mile-long, mile-wide tank trap of, you know, physical obstacles, mines, drones, artillery, kill zones. And it was insane. Anybody who looked at it. And then they kept quoting Finnan. Well, look what the Finns did in 1939. Well, yeah, they killed 500,000 Russians. And then finally they realized that it was hopeless and they cut a deal with them. And they gave up parts of Finland and they promised that they would not use their troops outside of Finland to help them, Germany. And that's what happened. So I'm very surprised at people who think that we're going to give them $60 billion, and then they're going to sink the Black Sea Fleet, and they're going to hit targets in Russia as militarily rational as it is. But no one, every time Putin or one of these crazy generals threatens to use tactical nuclear, oh, he would never do that. And then they have a whole different moral code with Ukraine. So here we are with these two wars. And we're telling the Israelis, do not be disproportionate, which is the only way you can win a war. And we're telling the Ukrainians, you got to be disproportionate. You got to hit them. Then we tell Israel, you got to have a ceasefire. And we tell Ukraine, anybody calls for a ceasefire is a Putin asset. And then we tell Israel, you got to have a coalition government. You have to get the opposition in. And we tell Zelensky, it's okay to cancel elections, outlaw political parties, suspend habeas corpus. And then we tell Israel, you've got no collateral damage. And then we basically say, you know, when you hit Crimea and Donbass, we don't really care who gets killed, just so you shoot at Russians. So it's mindless. And I had a close friend that I won't mention got very angry at me. And I said, he crossed a border. And I said, well, what are the borders of Ukraine? Well, they've been there they have not. Stalin went in to Poland in 1939, which was Western Ukraine today. He did not give it up. He went in with Hitler, and then he did not give it up after we helped him survive. And so we cut a deal with Stalin and said, okay. And that was the famous remark, you know, how many divisions does the Pope have? When they ask him not to ethnically cleanse Polish-speaking Roman Catholics from what now is a quarter of Ukraine. And he just ethnically cleansed them. And then we said to the Poles, okay, we don't want to ruffle those feathers. You don't own that anymore. Now it's Soviet Ukraine. However, we're going to give you East Prussia. So we ethnically cleansed 14 million Germans who had it coming, I guess, and we gave that to Poland. So what is now Ukraine has been fluid, and Crimea has been Russia since 1783. And when it broke up, the Soviet Union, the first thing Russia did was saying, we want Ukraine. And independent Ukraine said, we want it. And Crimea said, no, we're going to be independent. And I understand that it would probably have been controlled by Russia, but Ukraine seized it in 1992-93. They just seized this independent little, it wasn't going to last long, but they did take it. And so there's a whole, I'm not arguing that Ukraine shouldn't fight back, but there's something weird about it. When Biden says to the Ukrainians, okay, I don't want you to hit any Russian oil installations. And I thought, well, you put sanctions on them. That was the point. Well, what he's saying is, if you hit their oil refineries, you're going to raise the price of oil. And the same thing is going to happen in the Middle East, because if I push Iran, and then I won't be elected. So here we are giving them $60 billion, including rockets and missiles and artillery shells. But we're saying don't get anywhere near a border distillery, because if you do, the price of oil will go up and I won't be elected. So there's something surreal about it all. And then finally, we take these completely fraudulent figures from Hamas of 30,000 plus killed, when it was probably 10,000 Hamas and 10,000 civilians, which is bad that civilians die, but not in the ratios per dead soldiers that we usually see in that type of fighting. But here we are in Ukraine. The New York Times said last August there had been over 700,000 dead, wounded, and missing Ukrainians in Russia. And now people have suggested in the subsequent 6 months, we're up to 850,000. So we're beyond the Battle of Verdun. We're up to the Battle of the Somme. And this is in Europe's doorstep. And no one ever says, my God, this is a meat grinder. It is destroying the manhood of Ukraine. They have lost 1/4 of their population has fled the country. The average age of a Ukrainian soldier is 42 years old. It's not that they're running out of weapons, they're running out of people. And they can't draft 18, 19, 20-year-olds because they're either working in the economy or they've left or they're resisting somehow. So we never get any of that. It's just a lot of it has to do with the whole topos of Trump was a Putin asset that was promulgated by the likes of John Brennan and James Clapper and Adam Schiff and Eric Saramella and Michael Vindman, which wasn't true. But of course, a lot of this is that these are Russians, and these are the guys that have tattoos and weird accents that play thugs in Hollywood movies. So we demonize the Russian people and we say they're no separate from Russia, but actually they're much more separate. I mean, from Putin, the Russian people are more separate than Putin, or as separate from Putin as Hamas is from Gazans. I think the Gazans support Hamas much more than Russian people support Putin. But we make this distinction. Oh, Gazans are not, they're not involved in this. They don't support what's going on. But Russians, they do. And we've, it's just, I don't know what the philosophy is, but it's deeply embedded with American domestic politics.
This is kind of a tangential question, but you briefly raised the issue in the book of advances in artificial intelligence or AI. What is your concern about our rush to apply AI to warfare?
Well, you know, any technology is only good as the people who create it and operate it. It's just a delivery system that speeds things up. But as someone who works in Silicon Valley at Stanford and sees these people, you know, when I go to eat or when they come on campus or when I write a column criticizing them and they call me about it, these are not nice people for the most part that are making these, whether it's, you know, warping the order of a Google search to reflect an ideological agenda or working with the FBI to suppress the laptop at Twitter or what Facebook does. But these are the people who are going to be doing AI. So they're not going to be very good custodians. There, and I mentioned in the book a Newsweek article, but there's been a lot of computer simulations at the Pentagon. One of them that was really kind of notorious was that they programmed a self-thinking missile. So they programmed in AI terms all of the potential threats, other missiles, running out of fuel, you name it. And they put AI encouragements or catalysts how to avoid those. So they launched the thing on the computer, and the missile did avoid planes. It did avoid bad weather. It did avoid anti-missile. And then they hit the kill button, and the missile turned around and went right back at the launcher. And at that point, they stopped the simulation. And so that was kind of a metaphor for, I don't think that we know what we're getting into militarily with AI. Although I can understand, I've talked to a lot of Israelis, and people suggest that AI has enhanced the effectiveness of Iron Dome and David Sling and the Arrow system to 95% efficacy. So there, if it's in the right hands, it can be used properly, but I'm not sure that people in Silicon Valley should be trusted with it.
Yeah, let me ask you a final question. You write in the book that the old mentalities and delusions that doomed the Thebans and the Carthaginians and the Byzantines and the Aztecs that you write about are still very much with us. I think a lot of people look around at what's going on in America and the West today, and they wonder if we are witnessing the end of everything, and that it's happening kind of like the Ernest Hemingway character described the process of how he went bankrupt gradually and then suddenly. Are we on a doomsday course? You've kind of touched on this already, but are we on a doomsday course, or can we turn this ocean liner around?
Well, we can certainly turn it around because it was self-induced, and that's the good news. The good news is that we didn't run out of food or fuel, or we're not suffering from a COVID epidemic, in which the lockdown was worse than the epidemic, but we could easily do it. The problem is, if we were to build a wall across the border and deport people here who broke our laws and say that no more catch and release, no more refugee status once you get here, or we said if you commit a felony, you go into a store, you rough up somebody, you steal, you're going to spend 5 years in prison, we're going to build the necessary prisons until you get the message, or we're going to pump oil, natural gas, and use coal until we have viable, competitive, market-driven alternatives, or we're going to really beef up the military, and to do so within a framework of balancing the budget, which means we're going to have to cut a lot of this entitlement. It's what Livy, the great historian of Rome, said, the medicine would be seen as worse than the disease. In other words, can you imagine the outcry? Racist, homophobic, protectionist, xenophobe, every type of, and then it would take a particular type of person to say, keep calling me, I don't care. And very few people can do that. Very few people can say, I welcome your hatred because you're destroying the country and we're going to do what's necessary to save it within constitutional means. But I think globalization is partly the culprit, because in this century, we created westernized markets of 7 billion people. And the people on the coast where the universities are, the corporate headquarters are, the government is, these intellectual cultural centers, they achieved a degree of wealth. The Mark Zuckerbergs, the Mike Bloombergs, the Bill Gates, that was stunning. $9 trillion of market capitalization in Silicon Valley alone. We've never seen that accumulation of wealth. And the muscular classes that were in mining and construction, assembly, agriculture, they lost out. They were outsourced or offshore to a greater degree. And then we created a self-perpetuating exegesis. We said, well, you don't know how to code, or we're going to shut down all the coal fields in West Virginia, or your deplorables, or clingers, or chumps, or dregs. And we kind of wrote off all the people who were in trade school. We created this refined elite class that in the media, in the corporate world, in academia, in law, insurance, investment, tech, who made a lot of money. You know, I noticed something was weird around 2003 when I would have a syndicated column and I started getting email from people who read it in the Philippines or, you know, in Jordan. And that had never happened before. And so some of us that were not using their hands suddenly found that there was an audience, or there was a clientele, or there was a market that was vast. And the people who didn't have access to that were really, and I was at this, as this was going on, I was also on a farm with my family, and they were going broke because everybody was vertically integrating. And just foreign food was flowing in without any, you know, tariff or anything. And it was destroying the small farming community and what it was as an ethical break on modernity. And so, yeah, I think affluence and leisure is really the culprit here. And this, if you look at all the problems, whether it's the contradictions in the transgendered movement or the open border or crime is just a construct or looting is social justice or what the universities are doing or the radical environmental climate change, you do come to a particular demographic, and that is a very affluent, often white, subset of the population that lives on the coast, wants their children to go to these particular universities, get a cattle brand degree, and they gravitate to these professions. And they've completely lost touch with the people of East Palestine, Ohio types. They don't know anything about where their food or their oil or their machinery comes from or what sustains them. And I found them to be, because unfortunately I spent most of my life with them, very dangerous people.
Fascinating. Victor, what is the best way for people to keep up with what you're doing?
Well, I have a website, Victor Hanson, Hanson, all small letters, .com, where every day I write two columns a week, and then I do four podcasts a week. They're there as well. And then I have a little paywall. It's pretty cheap, just $5 a month, where I have 3 days a week an essay, usually on farming or something, sometimes about the news. Sometimes I print the letters I get that are pretty crazy, angry readers. Yes. It's kind of funny. I print the ones that I can print that don't have every word is the F word.
All right, good to know. Victor Davis Hanson, thank you for coming on The Right Take. Please keep up the great work.
Well, thank you for having me.
Listeners, I highly recommend Victor Davis Hanson's book, The End of Everything, to get the big picture wisdom and historical perspective that you need on current events. And thank you for joining me here at the intersection of politics and culture. Don't forget to subscribe to The Right Take so you can keep up with all the important conversations we're having here. And if you like what you hear, please leave that positive review. Be seeing you. The Right Take with Mark Tapson is a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center and Front Page Magazine. Unauthorized reproduction of this podcast without express written consent is prohibited.